Welcome to Bridging the Gap. We are Alaskans discussing issues that divide us in order to find solutions that will unite us. Welcome to Bridging the Gap. Today is the 33rd in a series of panel discussions of Alaskans examining issues that divide us politically in these turbulent times. My name is Paul Thomas. I live in Trapper Creek. The objective of the panel discussion is to derive through questions posed to the participants an understanding of the causes that have resulted in the current polarization of American political discourse. Subsequent to achieving a satisfactory understanding of the causes, it is hoped that through further discussion, a strategy for positive interaction can be constructed, which can achieve a respectful accommodation of each side towards the other. Today we have Rick Maestrom, Samantha Finkenbinder, and Mike Molesky is in for our as a substitute, which we may end up having a substitution of him later on in the show. But we're going to be talking about the Fourth Estate. And in researching the topic, I tried to find the origin of the phrase. It appears to be a hybrid from the French and the British Enlightenment thinkers, where the estates of the clergy and the aristocracy and the commons being the first three estates. The need for the fourth emerged as a vehicle to keep the other estates accountable. Do you guys have anything to add to what I researched as far as the origin, the history of the Fourth Estate, or is
not? I don't. Except I was thinking on the way here. I said, "What the heck is that? The origin of that? Where did that come from?" And I presumed it was from the three. And I was wrongly presumed, but the three divisions of government we have. We had the legislative, we had the administration, and judicial. And I presume the Fourth Estate was coined by journalists in America as the fourth branch of government. But yeah, that's not the case.
No, it came from the French and the British Enlightenment.
Very interesting.
Well, you know, I think the one that comes back to mind from a lot of years ago, school, was Oscar Wilde was quoted as saying that we are dominated by journalism. And he was referring to the Fourth Estate. And he was referring to the lords, the clergy, and the commons, the House of Commons. And I forget the quote directly, but it was more or less, the lords have nothing to say. The clergy has a lot to say, but nobody cares. And the House of Commons has a lot to say, but nobody wants to listen, or something along those lines. And that's more or less referring to what the Fourth Estate
is. So what is your understanding of the term now? Rick, you already kind of alluded to that a little bit. What elements of today's global society do you consider as participants or members of the Fourth Estate?
Well, I look at it now, and I'll speak as an American who's followed American politics a lot and grew up with American politics and understand and studied other political countries and different politics in their countries. But for America, it really is the presumption that that's the fourth branch of influence in government. Not the fourth branch of government, but the fourth branch of influence.
Influence is a good way to describe
it. Yeah, and I think it does. It plays a big part of it, and I think we've seen that. Gosh, we saw that in the late 60s when there was all kinds of turmoil in the country, and we're seeing it right now with a president that's very controversial. And that fourth branch has taken on a life of its own and has taken positions on it, whether rightfully or wrongfully. They should have. They've done it.
Mike, you have anything to add?
Well, I've recently been privileged to interview a New York Times editor. And there's been a publication of a book looking back over the entire history of the New York Times with selections from articles that have occurred over all of that time. And I found that fascinating because it reminded me that there has been an historical use of media, whether we're going back to the time of the Revolution and we're talking about pamphleting, whether we're talking about newspaper development, but also that the newspapers, how they wrote, reflected in part the culture of the times. If you go back to the 1860s, 1870s, and you read what was written at that time, it's instructive.
And inflammatory, a lot of it was.
And most recently, with the death of George H.W. Bush, there was a resurgence of discussion about a time not so far ago, much more recent, looking at that president's involvement with the press. Maureen O'Dowd comes to mind as she spoke about the relationship as a journalist who attacked him in many ways, but had a relationship. And so what comes from to me is the question of how connected reporters, the press, whether you're an owner, a publisher of a newspaper. In Anchorage, we've had it in the early days of Anchorage and Alaska, we had a publisher of a paper with great deal of influence. And the question to me is, how has that changed as we look at about now? And I'll just throw in one last cherry on top, the development of technology. Mm-hmm. So you don't have to wait for that paper to be delivered 6 weeks after it's published.
Sam, what's your understanding of what it is today?
Of the Fourth Estate? Well, I think it's interesting that Mr. Maestrom brought up calling it the Fourth Branch, because that is very much a significant difference between calling it the Fourth Estate and the Fourth Branch. When you call it the Fourth Branch, you're making the assumption then, and a lot of people do, and it's not incorrect to do so, that it is therefore part of our governing system, which I think is such a dichotomy and so much of a difference that we need to be making. The press should not be a part of our government, and yet it's so much a part of who we are as a people and a culture and our opinion of the government. Because how do we hear about the government except through the press?
Right. The Rick's word was influence.
Right. And that is a correct word to use.
The fourth branch of influence.
Absolutely.
Are we sitting in this studio part of the process, the Fourth Estate?
Oh, the electronic media or us?
The entire Fourth Estate.
You know, I think anybody who is and maybe the Fourth Estate now includes all the bloggers and all the people involved in their opinions and using Facebook and Instagram and all of those. So
don't you think it
may
does?
Be very expanded, but then what you have is you have a loss of having to adhere to a certain standard of ethics that generally the papers and the TV stations and the more mass media adhere to. You know, your average blogger who's out there or somebody who's posting something on Facebook or Instagram may not have even thought about their ethical responsibility.
But do you think everybody believes that those standards are being adhered to?
I have seen great wavering of those standards, in my opinion. Mm-hmm.
Over
the last 8 years
it.
Or 10 years, and maybe it's just that I'm much more sensitive to it than I was before. But I see the general mass media moving away from and I look at the New York Times. I subscribe to the New York Times as well as the Wall Street Journal, and I read them every day, as well as the Daily News. And I see the New York Times becoming a real advocacy journal more than a newspaper in my mind.
So why do you still subscribe to it if you're seeing that?
Because it's a good paper. There's a lot of interesting stuff. There's a lot of interesting stuff in it. You can, you know, as much as I dislike that, I find myself going first to the New York Times and then to the Wall Street Journal.
Yeah.
Because it's a fascinating paper.
Okay, Rick brought up the point, adherence to standards.
Well, this discussion has been going on, if you will, if you follow what comes out of journalism schools, for example, people who are doing courses in ethical standards and the rest of it, or if you talk to people who are reporters at the present time. We have close relationship with a number of reporters, and when we have interchange with them, their ability to be correct, starting at the simplest level, to report fact, to separate out someone's hearsay statement. You know, I heard that and fostered that as a rumor. We're careful in particular during the recent earthquake coverage. We were on the air for a long time, and quickly we said, okay, if someone's calling in to give us information as a junior member of the Fourth Estate, then we want to know what you saw, not what you heard. And we were very careful, even on that simplest level. So I think that there are still standards. The problem, I believe, when we look at any of the newspapers or even other forms of media, there's been a dispersal of the information gathering to people that they have varying backgrounds. But we have smaller and smaller number of people, whether it's the ADN or the New York Times in some respect, who are able to spend the time to do good work. So there's a shortening of that. So that's why I look back. I'd like to look back 10 years or 20 years and then make a comparison to an article that was written then, fitting it in and seeing if a paper from 10 years ago contained better journalism with more attention to detail. And even though you can get that information quickly, is it thought about and written better up to those standards today?
It's interesting to look back over 100 years back to like the time of Lincoln and the newspaper articles then, how yes. vitriolic they were. But Sam, I want you to comment on Rick's notion of adherence to standards. How do you see those adherence to standards? You see them happening? Or
well, I just need to add, yes, absolutely. We in this room are part of the fourth state as we were recording our thoughts. And I think anything other than an internal monologue you're putting out of your face, out of your mouth, whether opinion or fact, you've suddenly become part of the fourth state, whether you wanted to or not.
So just talking to people.
Just talking to people yeah. about okay. your opinions and factual matters. Yeah, absolutely. You're becoming part of the influence. Now, standards. Well, I know I homeschooled my kids up until my daughter till sixth grade. And there's a very important part of civics where you start in elementary school teaching children. And they're all taught this, not just in homeschool. What is a fact? What is an opinion? And I think that's where standards lie, isn't it? If you're speaking fact, then everybody should more or less have the same version of a fact. You know, they say that truth has three parts, yours, mine, and the truth. Mm-hmm. Those should all three mirror each other a bit. So the standard opinion and fact, you're going to get a crossover there somewhere, and I think that's where the dichotomy lies.
I think one nice thing about newspapers today is they have, you know, the news section and they have the editorial page where it is actual opinion. And so they actually specify this is the opinion.
Right.
But we don't necessarily see that on TV. But let me move on to the internet. Many people get all their news from the internet, particularly Facebook posts. We know that there is an equal chance of reading a lie or the truth on the computer screen. How do you assess the internet's legitimacy as a tool of the Fourth Estate?
Well, I'll just throw out that one of the major issues that's being discussed today, particularly in the use of the internet, is just to what degree an organization can create false postings and spread them. I think there has been sufficient research done to say yes, whether it happens to be an election or happens to be any other topic, because of the magic of the technology, where before you would have an article written by David Ignatius or someone and you'd say, he wrote that, he said that, and I'm reading it. Now you have something that's put out and then is spread in such a way that it becomes the background noise that people hear and begin after repetition to think, oh, that must be a foundational fact. And I think that's one aspect of the internet-based information sourcing that's problematic.
Rick, the legitimacy of the internet?
You know, I wrote a paper in college 50 years ago, 52 or 53 years ago, I think, when I was a sophomore.
You're good with numbers if you can specify
yeah.
them.
I wrote a paper called The Social Responsibility of the Audience. And it was – and my older sister said, no, you mean the speaker, don't you? I said, no, I mean the audience. And that's what I would – that's how I'd respond to your question, Paul. And that is, I think the authenticity of the internet is the responsibility of the listener and the reader. You need to weigh that against – your body of knowledge and say, that doesn't make sense. That does make sense. That does. That's interesting, but I better find out more about that, or I better find out if it's authentic. So I think there's a social responsibility that we as the audience have to challenge those things that just don't make sense to us and don't pass them on as fact. So in terms of authenticity, it's such a broad, there's so much coming at us from the internet that you can't measure all of those things, but you just need to take the responsibility of not saying, yeah, I read it on the internet, it must be true. You have a responsibility.
Mm-hmm. I agree with Mr. Maestrom completely there. I think that one thing the internet's given us is such an amazing bounty of information. And regardless of your education level, you can pretty much self-educate these days, or nearly. And I think that's wonderful. But unfortunately, when it comes to dissemination of media, you can get locked in an echo chamber so easily. And it really is on you to realize, my goodness, I'm going down this road of I'm hearing everything that I already believe, and I just keep going back to it like a dog back to its own vomit, more or less. It's just, and it can feed into that, and it's insidious. Facebook is one of the worst for feeding that echo chamber, mm-hmm. and I find that distasteful.
Yeah, this is Bridging the Gap on KVRF, Big Cabbage Radio, Radio Free Palmer. Today we're talking about the Fourth Estate with Mike Molesky, Rick Maestrom, Samantha Finkenbinder. There have been a number of recent examples of journalism where decisions were made to publish information that the government considered classified. One was the Pentagon Papers, supplied by Daniel Ellsberg, published by the New York Times and the Washington Post, which exposed government lies about Vietnam. And another was information about the extent of electronic surveillance on American citizens, exposed by Edward Snowden, published by The Guardian. How important is it for journalists to expose government secrets to citizens? Sometimes they risk their freedom to do so. Is that a necessary aspect of the Fourth Estate for our free society? Or is that something Mike doesn't even want to talk about that.
I would say yes, absolutely. Yes, absolutely. I think that is the burden of the free press. Absolutely. And I think to add to what you've listed there with the Pentagon Papers and Edward Snowden, I would add the Panama Papers, mm-hmm. Which were leaked. And we haven't even seen the surface of that one yet. In fact, that is piled so far underneath the water hose we're drinking out of, the fire hose we're drinking out of every day. I think I'd like to hear more about those Panama Papers.
I didn't mention Watergate either, which was a Washington Post expose.
Yeah, yeah.
So...
Yeah, I agree with Samantha. I probably won't say it as articulately as she did.
But I'll, I don't know about that.
Do your best, buddy.
I won't refer to the dog vomit or anything like that.
Sorry.
But, in fact, Mike Gravel, I think, read the – our former senator from Alaska
right.
read the Pentagon Papers at midnight and actually
I remember seeing
them.
That, yeah.
Publicized them. And I ran into him in the airport one time. I was a young guy, just came into Alaska, and I said I thought that was a good thing that you did.
Showed a lot of leadership there, a lot of guts.
I thought it really did. You know, he took a big chance, I thought. And they, as I was talking, he had somebody taking notes, and they got my name, and he called me up a couple of days later and said, I want to get together with more young people in Alaska and talk with them. And they invited me to talk with them. And so I'm in Alaska for 2 months, and I'm meeting with the U.S. senator from Alaska. I thought, I like this state. But I think that I think there is a responsibility. The question is do we have a response, or does, you know, should the media, should the Fourth Estate publish?
Is that a necessary aspect?
Okay, is it a necessary aspect? And, you know, if the answer is yes, I agree with what Samantha said. It is a necessary aspect. And a lot of times I'm frustrated by the fact they said an anonymous choice because he wasn't – anonymous source because he wasn't supposed to relay this. But on the other hand, it's very important – you know, it's Ronald Reagan's old saying of trust but verify, and you can trust your government, but it doesn't always earn that trust and doesn't always deserve that trust. So I think that bringing out things that may be state secrets, I think there's a responsibility there in a democracy.
So I have a slightly different facet of this question. I recently watched a movie – which was based on a book written by the producer that worked with Dan Rather when, if you remember back, this was the time of George Bush running for the presidency.
Which George Bush?
The George W. Okay. Bush. And the question that had been around for a while was, when he was in the Air National Guard, mm-hmm. was there a period of time, a year, where he didn't report for anything? And this was a question that had floated a bit. And so Dan Rather, respected journalist, okay, was brought a piece by his basically the person, the producer that worked with this. And what was interesting both about the book and the movie was the question of how much went into verifying, because that's what we've been talking about. And the producer spent a lot of time, organized a team, had to go to the company and say, okay, should we run with this? It's going to cost something because we really have to check this down. This isn't something we can play with. And they went through months of all kinds of stuff, gathered information. But in the end, it turned out that the basis for what they were producing, some papers, was not quite as solid as they had thought. But the sense was that they weren't running with something they knew was bad. They ran with something that they thought they had proven, and it turned not to be so. Well, Dan Rather stopped. He had come to the end of his career in any case.
It killed his career, essentially.
Well, it killed it in the sense it gave him an – I would put it this way. It gave him an opportunity to leave a position which he had occupied for so long that at some point, whether he was going to die on screen or whatever, he was nearing the end. But the producer was another case, and she went on to do some other things. But I think what I wanted to say was this was a dramatization based upon a book that she had written, a memoir. And it can be researched, has been. If you check out, you'll find some varying points about it. But it was a legitimate topic that they researched and put all the energies they had, well, not unlimited monies, but significant. And yet they still, with something like that, found it very difficult to get down and answer the question, is it true or not?
They got it wrong.
Well, this is what they got wrong. And this is the point because I had remembered it in a certain way. What they had gotten wrong was that the papers were not proof. But the fact of whether it happened or not was never really satisfied. It wasn't one of those cases where, yeah, we have proof now that he indeed did attend all of his trainings, et cetera. It was not there. There was nothing to prove it, but there was nothing to disprove it because the paper, the individuals they talked with, et cetera, were that way. What I'm saying, it still leaves a question because it wasn't a definitive answer, but because it was happening in the hurry of an election, it was a significant national issue, it's gone away. And that leads me to the last point about it. I was thinking about myself. How had I remembered that? I remembered something about Dan Rather not doing his job well. But the reality was he had done his job depending upon – and that comes down to the question of if you're a reporter and you're dependent upon people who are bringing you materials that are saying this – you know, whether you happen to be a mayor or something, you bring it to you and you say, okay – tell me you've done due diligence. Can I ask any question about this that shows that there's something wrong here? And everything that he did over a lengthy period of time was to say, prove it. I'm not going to go with this unless you can prove it to me. And that's a kind of a case example, and I won't perseverate on that one, but how difficult it is sometimes to pin down what actually happened, even if you're searching for the truth, if you will.
I notice on TV these days, a lot of times, like a guy from the Washington Post, Phil Rucker, whenever they talk about what's happened in the White House, he says, well, we've had multiple sources. So they don't just rest on just a couple people they talk to. They talk to a lot of people. Another big expose was told in the movie Spotlight, which showed how the child abuse scandal in the Archdiocese of Boston was uncovered by reporters working for the Boston Globe. Is there any other way to prevent corruption by established institutions such as the government or the church than with journalism like this. If we don't have journalism to go into these places and find out what's going on, is there any other way to prevent an organization from being corrupt?
You know, I'm not sure I can answer specifically that question, is there any other way, but I think that's a very important role of the press. You know, as frustrated as I was sometime as mayor with the press writing stories on a daily basis about what we were doing in Anchorage with two newspapers covering it and both having a little different, a big different orientation toward politics, it was very frustrating, but I also never, ever felt that we'd be better off without that. It can be frustrating. It's tough. But I know a lot of times when we would have our staff meetings in the morning, we would find ourselves saying, okay, how are the newspapers going to cover this? What's their reaction? And I think most times we may have improved what we were going to do. You know, it wasn't just a sensitivity to it, but we asked ourselves, can we do better? You know, can we do something differently?
And you attribute to journalism's input into the process what helped you improve your product.
I think it did. Mm-hmm. I think it made us better.
I would give a definitive no. These corporations and entities, such as the Catholic Church or a corporation,
or the government,
no, absolutely, they're not going to self-correct. Until enough people get angry. And how do people get angry? They don't get angry unless they have the information. Mm-hmm. And that's what the press is all about. It's about informing people. That is the basic for it. And, you know, in the case of Spotlight, which I thought was a fabulous movie, by the way, just opinion, how many people would have known that? And so many people would have just buried their foot in the sand and said, no, I'm not moving from my opinion until I hear. Well, you start stacking up the boys who came forth. And it's kind of like Jerry Sandusky, too. How many people were, you know, Penn State, go? It's like, you know, just
actually, the first criminal complaint on Jerry Sandusky occurred in 1978.
Yeah, it was quite a while ago, wasn't it? But it still took a lot more. Yeah. But that all had to be disseminated through the press.
And then it came, you know, with Jerry Sandusky, it came from a reporter from the Harrisburg paper that really pushed it to the extent that it got out. Mm-hmm. Anything besides journalism going to keep these guys straight, Mike?
That's a wonderful question. And I was trying to think of the only other group that plays out there are academicians who are not necessarily journalists, who do studies. Someone who studies a particular topic in depth, an author who writes a book. I separate those people from journalists, et cetera. But I would agree with all of you. And for that matter, from the day of the founding fathers and before the revolution, there was a recognition, no matter how bad you were attacked, for example, maybe inappropriately, that having that was the most significant thing to keeping people informed, et cetera. This last earthquake, if you were to look out, as we did, because we had three people searching for information about what was happening, I can say that the municipality of Anchorage did a wonderful job. They had immediate information available. We have a group of PIOs, public information officers for various entities, school districts, et cetera. And they got that information out. And they would hold press conferences so that the press could get that information and put it out properly. And I think in those acute situations where you have an emergency, that's where the press shines.
Mm-hmm. This is Bridging the Gap on KVRF, Big Cabbage Radio, Radio Free Palmer. We're talking about the Fourth Estate with Mike Molesky, Rick Meistrom, Samantha Finkenbinder. Rick, you had something you were going to say.
Yeah, right? I was just going to follow up on this, the same item about, is there anybody else? And you mentioned, I think, Paul, that it was the Fourth Estate, was it the Fourth Estate that keeps government and other big corporations, the Catholic Church, et cetera, and what else would keep them in check? And I would say it really is not the Fourth Estate. It's the public opinion that keeps them in check. But the Fourth Estate is the vehicle that public opinion finds out about.
Shapes the public opinion.
Yeah, that shapes the public opinion. Ultimately, it's the public opinion that does it. If any, and I've often thought, if any corporation would have done the things that the members of the Catholic Church had done. If Exxon, if you can imagine, if they had gone through and done the same thing that the Catholic Church had done, they would have been bankrupt and out of business and just absolutely ostracized and gone. The Catholic Church is able to survive for whatever reason. I don't know.
Well, this is a good segue into the next question. A great deal of news information is disseminated on TV. The major networks, CBS, NBC, and ABC, had their morning shows, Good Morning America Today and CBS This Morning, as well as their 30-minute evening reports. On cable, we have Fox, CNN, MSNBC. What is your assessment of the product we get from TV journalism in 2018?
I honestly...
That's what we're here for, honest evaluation.
I don't know. It's going to sound horrible, but I remember in the 80s and 90s, you could judge a person, and you regardless of who you were, we all judge each other, you would judge a person based upon the paper you saw them reading in public, like at a coffee shop, or the paper they had wrapped up underneath their arm.
That's pretty judgmental.
And if it was Washington Post, you judge them as a hardcore liberal, right? If it was the National Review, you're like, well, there's a conservative. Now, today, what do? You see somebody watching MSNBC, oh, well, there's a moderate to liberal. Or you see them watching Fox News, what do you say in your head? You may not blurt it out of your face, but you're going to think in your brain, I know what that person's all about. I know what side of the line they're on.
So what kind of person they are depends on what news show they watch on TV.
Well, it shouldn't. But we all make that assumption, don't we? And I think it's because of what these... Honestly, the morning TV shows, I see those as just filler and entertainment. Mm-hmm. Honestly, they all kind of are just entertainment. They're all very salacious, every single one of them. I mean, if they pack their factual news stories into one segment, what would it be, 2 hours in a 24-hour period? Maybe. Maybe.
What's your assessment of TV journalism, Rick?
Well, a big change. I'm 75 years old, so I look back at that. You know, I was raised in the area of Eric Severide and Walter Cronkite, and not raised in the area, but that became very interested during that time. And I always thought, you know, what they said was just the truth. That was it.
You felt that way about Walter Cronkite, that's for sure.
Walter Cronkite, yeah. For sure. Yeah, yeah, you felt that way. He just seemed, and he was the one that first came back from Vietnam and said, we're not winning. We're not going to win this war. This is not going to work. We shouldn't be there. And mm-hmm. and he had always – so he had opinions too. You know, it wasn't – he wasn't free from that. Now certainly there are stations and they all have their opinions. And I don't look at MSNBC as just a moderately liberal station as Samantha does. I look at it as a very liberal station. Mm-hmm. But in general, you know, even those stories like the Good Morning, the different Good Morning shows, it's who they have on and what they do. And they just want to publicize their opinions. And going back to what Samantha said about 10 minutes ago, and she referred to echo chambers, and that is so much a problem, not only in television newsrooms, but also in print newsrooms. Hmm. You start, if you're in the newsroom of the New York Times or the Anchorage Daily News or which I've never been in the newsroom of the New York Times, but the Anchorage Daily News and the Anchorage Times, I'd been in the newsroom there and start talking to people. And they meld into the same opinions. There isn't a variety of opinions in those newsrooms, and I presume the same on television stations. So I know that now Fox, in terms of cable, has a huge listening audience. I think they're bigger than all the other cable ones combined. But it's because I think that the networks slanted to the left for a long time. And this is a response, and they're saying we need a voice out there. And people said, aha, there's somebody that's talking my language. Mm-hmm. So I think that's why Fox has gotten so popular, become so popular, because in general, even though the network news is more subtle about it, they're more liberal in terms of what they cover and how they cover it and you know, what their opinions show. So I don't know that they're any less responsible than newspapers. Probably are. They probably are. I think newspapers try harder to get things verified, but it no longer there are advocacy TV stations. There's advocacy radio stations. There's no longer just news out there. It moves one direction or the other, or communicates one direction or the other.
So are these cable stations more opinion and less news, you think?
I think opinion heavily influences what news they cover and how often they cover it.
Or more ideological Fox. Bent, possibly, to it.
Yeah, I think it does. I mean, Fox News will cover all of the problems with the Mueller investigation and why has this been going on for almost a year and a half and nothing's there? They'll focus on that, and you get a station on, you get MSNBC, and they talk about the things that Mueller's finding. You know, look at what he's found now. Look at what that's, mm-hmm. and it's just two different takes on it. Mm-hmm. And so you have to be perceptive enough. It comes back to the social or intellectual responsibility of the audience. You have to be able to sort that out.
You're a big fan of Morning Joe. Mika and Joe.
Not so much Mika and Joe, although they're pleasant eye candy. What I would say is, more importantly, is I respect many of the people. John Meacham, for example, mm-hmm. historian of note. He's good.
Presidential historian.
Oh, yes. Yeah. I mean, when he speaks, I listen mm-hmm. because I know he's going to speak.
And he's a regular on that morning.
He is a regular guy. Yeah. So I look very carefully to those people, and I listen to them. The pattern between, that's the glue that maybe holds it together, but I listen there. But as you were talking, I was thinking, okay, I hunger for something that I can sink my teeth into when I go to, whether it's Huffington Post or CNN or any of the rest. So what I end up doing, I have a subscription to The New Yorker, and there are other magazines with uh-huh. slightly different slant. But when I read a New Yorker article, my wife does the same, we come away with a lot of stuff, a lot of background, detail, et cetera, that raises questions that we can use. But I don't find that in the either TV journalism, generally speaking, or even in print media. New York Times, Washington Post, Wall Street Journal, they all do have their long articles. But you have to seek them out and find them and not be just sticking to the headlines.
Yeah, I think what I miss most are people – I miss somebody like Charles Krauthelmer. And he may not be agreeable to everybody in the room, but the man knew his stuff,
exactly.
And he wrote so well, and how beautifully spoken, and, you know, of course, rest in peace. But I miss that kind of solid journalism where, yes, he had opinions, but, man, were they backed up by facts, and he could source them, and he could state them. A current person who I enjoy reading, even though I'm a bit of a moderate, is Jonah Goldberg, National Review. Excellent, excellent journalist, excellent writer. I miss Christopher Hitchens. You know, whatever you feel about that guy, I kind of miss his journalism. It was straightforward. It was easy. He sourced it well. And I could kind of rely on it. I knew it had his bent or, you know, Charles had his bent and so on and so forth. But I knew what it was. A lot of times when I turn on Fox News or I turn on MSNBC, I'm not quite sure, even though it seems glaringly obvious. Sometimes I'm not quite sure where these people are coming from as far as sources and facts, and that bothers me. So I usually don't quote those sources when talking to people, you know.
I'm annoyed by the personalities of MSNBC.
It's a little aggravating.
Yeah. I miss Krauthelmer, too.
Right? What a wonderful guy.
He really was. Very smart guy.
Entertaining and smart. So smart.
So maybe I'd like to ask a question, Paul, if I may.
Oh, yeah. Let me ask a question, buddy. Go ahead.
Because so far what we've been doing, as we've been talking in a kind of a global sense about this, I'd like to bring it maybe back to Alaska. We've all been here in Alaska for a while. Is there a reporter, a news source in Alaska that you look toward and look forward to reading, hearing, et cetera? Let's think about the more local type of thing.
Okay, I can open this up with I'm impressed with Maria Downey. I have a personal connection to her, albeit somewhat distant. And I have to hand it to the woman. She knew my personal story with what happened to my husband. And I had emailed her and said that I thought it would be a good idea for maybe them to look into talking about flying in Alaska and some of the perils of it. And I said, you know, I don't want my husband brought into this. And she agreed, and she didn't even touch it with a 10-foot pole. And I thought that was so – it's a good story. You could go with it. She could have ignored me outright. And the woman was so polite about it. And just – I've never known her to not have integrity, but that's my personal opinion and encounter. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You know, well, the Daily News is my source mm-hmm. now. That's what I read on a regular basis. Don't always agree with them. In fact, often don't agree with although they're editorial positions now. I'm more and more comfortable with editorial positions. And, you know, I had a couple of letters to the editor that didn't get published during this past election, and they explained that they do it based on the percentage of total. You look at it and you see more liberal positions, more liberal letters to the editor than conservative letters to the editor. But they gave me what I thought was a very good answer. Actually, a friend of mine called because I didn't get on there. But they gave him what I thought was a very good answer. And they said they published a percentage based on the proportion of articles on either side that they receive.
Now, was your letter about an issue or a particular candidate?
It was about a candidate.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah, it was about Mike Dunleavy. Mm-hmm. But that was fair, I thought. Mm-hmm. You know, if they get most of them are supporting Mark Begich, they put a lot more letters in. You know, if 60% of the letters they get are Mark Begich letters, they'll put 60% in the paper. And I thought that was fair. But I do miss having other opinions in here. And I kind of loved it when we had two newspapers, the Times and the News. That was very we were actually one of the smaller cities in the country that had two major newspapers, two daily newspapers. But it's different now that there's a difference between the Times was run by Bob Atwood, the publisher, and the opinions and his – Bill Tobin was his main editorial writer and Tom Brennan was another one. And they were – I mean they had to answer to Bob Atwood. Now you talk to the Daily News folks and they are very – insistent, and I think they were then too, of saying there are two distinct branches of our newspaper. There's the publisher, but then there's the news branch, mm-hmm. and the news branch is independent. Our responsibility is to publish what they feel are the facts and they feel are the right opinions.
And the publisher allows that independence. Right?
And the publisher does, and I think.
So we have to give him credit for that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And when Fuller Cowell was publisher of the Daily News. I thought he's a very bright guy, a good guy, but he insisted that too that the editorial board had a big role, and they had the publisher was the publisher. He was the leader in terms of business, but he didn't try to overduly influence the editorial part of it.
When I was reading, I'll let you get in a minute, but I was reading the Team of Rivals, Doris Kearns Goodwin's book. And when William Seward was running against Abraham Lincoln for the Republican nomination in 1860, his hometown, I forget the name of it, it was up in New York, had 15 daily newspapers.
Really?
Yeah, 15. So I just had to get that bit of trivia in because I always thought that, you know, it's interesting how our journalism has evolved. We don't have as many newspapers as we used to. We used to have two in Anchorage. Now we just have one. I think we have one in Alaska, right? I mean, isn't the Anchorage Daily News now the Alaska Daily News? And
Fairbanks News Miner is independently owned and operated.
And that's still operating.
Still operating. It's owned by the
I heard at one point there was a merger, foundation. But I could be wrong. Go ahead, Mike. Who's your favorite news person here?
Okay, so I'm going to look back in history first to say I miss a certain columnist because we've been talking about editorial and we've been talking about reporting. But then there's that in-between thing. That's represented, in my experience, by Mike Dugan.
Oh.
Now, there was a guy, I can tell you, I opened that paper, I read his. If I didn't look at anything else, I read it because he was a good writer. Yep. He was a good writer, from my perspective. Now, one guy that I tend to do the same with, although they're in a different category of writing, is someone who has the most recent piece that I found fascinating, and that's Charles Wolforth. He went back and he presented a picture in the paper, if you haven't seen it, you need to, of a coterie of people at Stellar High School that included Tuckerman Babcock, Mark Begich, Tom Begich, a guy by the name of Guess, Charles Wolfirth. All of these people came out of Stellar High School and went on to do the things they're doing today. But what he did was he did a marvelous, again, from my standpoint, backgrounding to give you some sense of these people, which we know now when we say Tuckerman Babcock is the chief of staff for the governor and Tom Begich is minority leader in the Senate. Well, but who are they? And I thought this was a very interesting way to show how they have interacted over the years and where they are today. That information I would never have had from any other source. Mm-hmm. So,
Let me follow up with Charles Wolfe,
sure,
if I can. There's a lot I like about Charles Wolfe. He was one, and he's a liberal. I'm more conservative. But he was on the assembly along with, when I was on the assembly, with Jane Anvik and Fred Chai and Bob Baird, a bunch of people. It was a 6-5 assembly, really, with a 5-5 assembly with me as sort of a moderate in the middle. But Charles Wolfirth was one of the few people on the assembly, along with Jane Anvik, that would admit they're liberals. The others who were liberals would say, no, I'm really the conservative voice of the hillside, Pat Abney or whatever. But he said, I'm a liberal. I believe in the liberal philosophy. And Jane Anvik said the same thing. I'm a liberal, and I believe in it. And I admire him for that.
No, yeah, you appreciate that. The honesty.
Yeah. It wasn't a word that was very popular then. Now, and now the liberals have sort of they've changed their name to progressive because liberals were so, you know, the word liberal.
It was pejorative. Liberal has become pejorative.
Yes.
In fact, whenever they were talking about in Michigan and Wisconsin how after the election, the assemblies are changing the ways in which the power of the governor, he came right out and said, it's because they have a liberal agenda and we need to stop it. And it's become a pejorative term. Now, is Trump's declaration of fake news a legitimate characterization? And if not, what is his motivation for his almost daily use of the phrase? Fake news. Is it legitimate for him to call things fake news?
You know, the way I'm going to answer that, I think, is that about a year ago, the New York Times published their list of the Trump lies, you know, what they said. And because somebody wrote into one of the columnists, it was either Charles Blow or Paul Krugman or Marine Dye, one of the columnists, and said, well, you don't talk about the Obama lies. And so they came up with two lies that Obama had made in the first, let's say it's a year and a half or so. And they had 385 Trump lies. Well, they started listing them. Well, you know, a lie is when you know something not to be true and you say it. When you say, you know, and I'd say at least 80% of those items that they call lies were just wrong statements. I mean, if he made a wrong statement, and nobody will ever say he's really well informed, but if he made a statement that was wrong, they counted that as a lie. And it's not a lie if you believe it's true. You know, you're wrong. And so, and then a number of them were just different opinions from the Times. But they, I think, I forget what was the question you asked me.
Fake news. Yes.
I think a lot of those things where they're talking about, when Trump was talking about fake news, was maybe those things that he was accused of lying and he was just wrong. I don't know that anybody tries to create news from it, but it's certainly a phrase that people have bought into, and I think that some deserved. I said it at the very start of the show that the New York Times, in, you know, Harvard, there was a Harvard study that said 93% of the news articles in the Times had a negative tone toward Trump. Then Harvard is not exactly the bastion of conservative ideology, but 93% had a negative tone toward Trump of the news articles, and that shouldn't be happening. So while that's not fake news, that certainly is advocacy news, not just straight news. So I think that's Trump's reason for his term of fake news.
Okay, well, isn't it possible that of that 93%, that there was a lot of negative that came out of that. Yeah. They cut to 93%.
Yeah, and maybe he deserves it. You know, either if you deserve, if you believe, people can say, yeah, well, he did a lot of stupid things, and maybe he deserved negative. But he doesn't necessarily deserve it in the news section of the paper. You know, you mentioned early that the papers had the opinion section and the news section. And the opinion section, I don't read the opinion section of the Times very often because I get their opinions in the news section. I go through the news, you know, I read the news section. I know what their opinions are because I've read the news every day.
Fake news legitimate, Sam?
Yeah, I understand where you're coming from, Mr. Maestrom. Completely. Makes total sense, except that he is our commander-in-chief. And anything that spills from his lips is going to become a part of our national history of this country. It goes into the presidential library, including every single tweet, misnomer, whatever. Covfefe, I think, is one that will become a part of the presidential library. Is he saying things that are wrong because he just doesn't know better? If that is the case, then he's making that his hill to die upon. Because even when he is told better, he sticks with his guns. And I can't say that a rational human being would stand there and make that their hill. And he has. That being said, there is fake news. There absolutely is fake news. I don't think you can say, oh, I'm wrong, I shouldn't have said that, and then say, ooh, fake news. No, of course not. That's ridiculous. Yes, there's fake news. I mean, it's been all over. What was it this last spring was Cambridge Analytica, which Trump campaign hired. Steve Bannon was on their board, and he pushed Trump's campaign to hire them. Cambridge Analytica is a UK company, for those who don't know. Mm-hmm. And, you know, they worked towards voter personality profiles. They even created a 120-question test, put it out on Facebook, and hoped people would take it to get these psychological profiles. Well, they did.
Yeah, one of my wife's classmates got caught up in that.
Oh, really? Yeah, right. Well, they collected something like 50 million mm-hmm. Facebook profiles. That's what came out. It was Facebook who later admitted, no, guys, it's 87 million Facebook profiles that were data mined for Cambridge Analytica. Now, what did Cambridge Analytica do? They didn't – it's kind of a twofer thing. You know, did they make people vote the way they voted because of fake news? Not necessarily. People voted the way they wanted to, I'm assuming. But if you're being – you know, if we are going to call it the fourth estate and we're going to say it's an influence, which we've already talked about here, then absolutely we were influenced with fake news. Absolutely, by corporations like Cambridge Analytica, by Russian trolls and bots who deliberately went in and using Facebook, they went in and they created articles that were just slightly tweaked off facts and truth to feed into this echo chamber that people put themselves in. And that is fake news, and it did absolutely. It worked. It worked for the politics.
Well, I think probably the president's ability to conflate an opinion about fake news with anyone who criticizes. That's what I see happening. Or not even criticizing so much, but persist in asking questions that he does not want to answer. You know, basically, we've watched this. This is the interesting thing. We've watched the press conferences and other times. And the comparison has been made, again, to George H.W. Bush. He had a somewhat contentious relationship with the press during his time. But his ability to handle, and other presidents, and the same thing, to be able to handle that, to be quick enough to say, well, I'll get back to you on that, or to be thick-skinned enough to deal with it. But I think what I see happening is because of very, very great sensitivity to any perceived criticism or lack of going in the direction I want you to go, immediately there's a kind of a red flag that comes up and out comes fake news. And that is not serving the president well. That's my opinion. I think he's overused it so much because it's one of the sound bites that he has used in order to, one, become president, and to persist with that. So it's almost, it's not thinking, it's just reflexive. And that's problematic, because I most people looking on that I would say, well, that's overuse. That's not true. Get to the point of what is and not separate that out. And I think that's the frustration many people feel.
Oh, I agree completely. And the other thing that immediately throwing the red flag on fake news or supposed fake news, what it does immediately in the listener's brain is it delegitimizes the source. It immediately makes you question, oh, maybe they're not right. And if you're not going to take the time out of your day to go and research that, you know, right before coming here, before I got in my car to get here, I actually was on Facebook, unfortunately. I rarely go on there anymore. But I can't help but creep occasionally. It's horrible. I know it's like an addiction. It's terrible. But I'm on there, and there's this article about something about candy canes and a teacher in Nebraska. I'm not even going to go into details because it's too ridiculous for words. But underneath this article, there was this little blurb from Snopes.com fact-checking it. And it's put on by Facebook. And it's even got a little blurb under the Snopes.com deal that says Facebook is committed to fact-checking articles. And it's like, you know, they're trying to re-legitimize themselves. Exactly. After what happened with them. But I found that so interesting that this article that just sounds ridiculous out of Nebraska, people could be like, oh, fake news, fake news. Either side of the aisle could be like, fake news, fake news. But poor little Facebook sitting over there going, hey, Snopes.com on this one, you know, we got your back. It delegitimizes when you throw that.
So to make, if I could paraphrase Mike's point, it was that Trump declares fake news things that he doesn't like or thinks he doesn't agree with.
Yeah.
You want to respond to that?
Well, you know, Trump unfortunately has a very limited vocabulary of the English language. He has about five or six words that he uses to describe all the good in the world, you know. Amazing, fantastic, best, you know.
Horrible.
Horrible.
Huge.
Yeah. It really is.
It's very strongly. Very strongly.
Bigly. Sorry. Go ahead.
Oh, you got
it. We agree. He doesn't have a good vocabulary that can describe with any sense of accuracy anything other than just the superlative.
Uh-huh.
Or the – what's the opposite of superlative?
I forget. The,
whatever it is. But – there's a sense when I was mayor, I'd read articles and I knew, and I'd read letters to the editor and I'd say, well, they're not right on this. This isn't right. They just don't know. But I didn't, after the first couple of times I started answering letters, and I stopped doing that after about the first four or five letters came in to the editor that I didn't like. But you know, he's just too sensitive to things. He reacts to things, and the whole fake news thing has just become a word that he uses to describe everything he doesn't like, and I don't think it's really helpful.
Okay, I want to thank Mike for sitting in, Rick, Sam. Appreciate your being by. All you out there in radio land, thanks for listening. Bye.
Thanks for listening to Bridging the Gap. We welcome diversified perspectives. If you are interested in becoming a panelist for a future show, send us an email to manager@radiofreepalmer.org.
This program is a production of Radio Free Palmer, recorded at our studios in Palmer, Alaska. The views and opinions of moderators and guests do not necessarily represent those of Radio Free Palmer, the station, or its underwriters.